Chapter 143. Most productive periods of the doctor's practice he united business with pleasure, and his chief place of resort was Ostend, which is much frequented by Germans, and where the doctor treated himself and his spouse to what he called a ib in the sea. His interesting patient, Jose, was a regular milch cow to the doctor, and he easily persuaded the civilian, both for his own health's sake, and that of his charming sister, which was really very much shattered, to pass the summer at that hideous seaport town. Emmy did not care where she went much. Georgie jumped at the idea of a move. As for Becky, she came as a matter of course in the fourth place inside of the fine barrage Mr. Joe's had bought, the two domestics being on the box in front. She might have some misgivings about the friends whom she should meet at Ostend, and who might be likely to tell ugly stories, but bah, she was strong enough to hold her own. As he had cast such an anchor in Joe's now as would require a strong storm to shake. That incident of the picture had finished him. Becky took down her elephant, and put it into the little box which S.E. had had from Amelia ever, so many years ago. Emmy also came off with her lares, her two pictures, and the party, finally, were lodged in an exceedingly dear and uncomfortable house at Ostend. There Amelia began to take baths, and get what good she could from them, and though scores of people of Becky's acquaintance passed her and cut her, yet Mrs. Osborne, who walked about with her, and who knew nobody, was not aware of the treatment experienced by the friend whom S.E. had chosen so judiciously as a companion. Indeed, Becky never thought fit to tell her what was passing under her innocent eyes. Some of Mrs. Rawdon Crawley's acquaintances, however, acknowledged her readily enough, perhaps more readily than she would have desired. Among those were Major Loader Unattached, and Captain Rook late of the Rifles, who might be seen any day on the dike, smoking, and staring at the women, and who speedily got an introduction to the hospitable board and select circle of Mr. Joseph Sedley. In fact, they would take no denial. They burst into the house, whether Becky was at home or not, walked into Mrs. Osborne's drawing room, which they perfumed with their coats and mustachios, called Joe's L.D. Buck, and invaded his dinner table, and laughed and drank for long hours there. What can they mean? Asked Georgie, who did not like these gentlemen. Heard the major say to Mrs. Crawley yesterday, "No, no, Becky, you shan't keep the old buck to yourself. We must have the bones in, or, dammy, I'll split." Apostrophe, apostrophe, what could the major mean, mama? Major. Don't call him major, Emmy said. I'm sure I can't tell what he meant. His presence and that of his friend inspired the little lady with intolerable terror and aversion. They paid her tipsy compliments. They leered at her over the dinner table. And the captain made her advances that filled her with sickening dismay, nor would she ever see him, unless as he had George by her side. Rebecca, to do her justice, never would let either of these men remain alone with Amelia. The major was disengaged too, and swore he would be the winner of her. A couple of ruffians were fighting for this innocent creature, gambling for her at her own table, and though she was not aware of the rascals' designs upon her, yet she felt a horror and uneasiness in their presence and longed to fly. She besought, she entreated Joe's to go. Not he. He was slow of movement, tied to his doctor, and perhaps to some other leading strings. At least Becky was not anxious to go to England. At last she took a great resolution, made the great plunge. She wrote off a letter to a friend whom S.E. had on the other side of the water, a letter about which she did not speak a word to anybody, which she carried herself to the post under her shawl, nor was any remark made about it, only that she looked very much flushed and agitated when Georgie met her, and she kissed him, and hung over him a great deal that night. She did not come out of her room after her return from her walk. Becky thought it was Major Loader and the captain who frightened her. She mustn't stop here, Becky reasoned with herself. As she must go away, the silly little fool. She is still whimpering after that gaby of a husband dead and served right. These 15 years. She shan't marry either of these men. It's too bad of Loder. No, she shall marry the bamboo cane. I'll settle it this very night. So Becky took a cup of tea to Amelia in her private apartment and found that lady in the company of her miniatures, and in a most melancholy and nervous condition. She laid down the cup of tea. Thank you, said Amelia. Listen to me, Amelia, said Becky, marching up and down the room before the other, and surveying her with a sort of contemptuous kindness. Want to talk to you. You must go away from here, and from the impertinences of these men. I won't have you harassed by them. And they will insult you if you stay. I tell you they are rascals. Men fit to send to the hulks. Never mind how I know them. I know everybody. Joe's can't protect you. He is too weak, and wants a protector himself. You are no more fit to live in the world than a baby in arms. You must marry, or you and your precious boy will go to ruin. You must have a husband, you fool, and one of the best gentlemen I ever saw has offered you 100 times, and you have rejected him, you silly, heartless, ungrateful little creature. I tried my best, indeed I did, Rebecca, said Amelia deprecatingly, but I couldn't forget, and she finished the sentence by looking up at the portrait. Couldn't forget him. Cried out Becky, that selfish humbug, that low-bred cockney dandy, that padded booby, who had neither wit, nor manners, nor heart, and was no more to be compared to your friend with the bamboo cane than you are to Queen Elizabeth. Why, the man was weary of you, and would have jilted you, but that Dobbin forced him to keep his word. He owned it to me. He never cared for you. He used to sneer about you to me, time after time, and made love to me the week after he married you. It's false. It's false. Rebecca, cried out Amelia, starting up. Look there, you fool, Becky said, still with provoking good humor, and taking a little paper out of her belt, she opened it, and flung it into Emmy's lap. Who know his handwriting? He wrote that to me, wanted me to run away with him, gave it me under your nose, the day before he was shot, and served him right, Becky repeated. Emmy did not hear her. She was looking at the letter. It was that which George had put into the bouquet, and given to Becky on the night of the Duchess of Richmond's ball. It was as she said. The foolish young man had asked her to fly. Emmy's head sank down, and for almost the last time in which she shall be called upon to weep in this history, she commenced that work. Her head fell to her bosom, and her hands went up to her eyes, and there for a while, she gave way to her emotions, as Becky stood on and regarded her. Who shall analyze those tears, and say whether they were sweet or bitter? Was she most grieved, because the idol of her life was tumbled down and shivered at her feet, or indignant that her love had been so despised, or glad because the barrier was removed which modesty had placed between her and a new, a real affection. Tea, there is nothing to forbid me now, she thought. I may love him with all my heart now. Oh, I will, if he will, but let me and forgive me. I believe it was this feeling rushed over all the others which agitated that gentle little bosom. Indeed, she did not cry, so much as Becky expected the other soothed, and kissed her, a rare mark of sympathy with Mrs. Becky. She treated Emmy like a child, and patted her head. Andy, now let us get pen, and ink, and write to him to come this minute, she said. I wrote to him this morning, Emmy said, blushing exceedingly. Becky screamed with laughter, and Biglietto, she sang out with Racina, Eccolo qua, the whole house echoed with her shrill singing. 2 mornings after this little scene, although the day was rainy and gusty, and Amelia had had an exceedingly wakeful night, listening to the wind roaring, and pitying all travelers by land and by water, yet she got up early, and insisted upon taking a walk on the dike with Georgie. And there she paced as the rain beat into her face, and she looked out westward across the dark sea line, and over the swollen billows which came tumbling and frothing to the shore. Neither spoke much, except now and then, when the boy said a few words to his timid companion, indicative of sympathy and protection. I hope he won't cross in such weather, Emmy said. I bet 10-1 he does, the boy answered. Ugh, mother, there's the smoke of the steamer. It was that signal, sure enough. But though the steamer was underway, he might not be on board. He might not have got the letter. He might not choose to come. 100 fears poured one over the other into the little heart, as fast as the waves onto the dike. The boat followed the smoke into sight. Georgie had a dandy telescope, and got the vessel under view in the most skillful manner. And he made appropriate nautical comments upon the manner of the approach of the steamer as she came nearer and nearer, dipping and rising in the water. The signal of an English steamer in sight went fluttering up to the mast on the pier. I dare say Mrs. Amelia's heart was in a similar flutter. Emmy tried to look through the telescope over George's shoulder, but she could make nothing of it. She only saw a black eclipse bobbing up and down before her eyes. George took the glass again, and raked the vessel. H, how she does pitch, he said. Here goes a wave slap over her bows. There's only two people on deck besides the steersman. There's a man lying down, and a chap in a cloak with a hooray. It's Dob, by jingo. He clapped to the telescope, and flung his arms round his mother. As for that lady, let us say what she did in the words of a favorite poet, Akruan Jelasasa. She was sure it was William. It could be no other. What as he had said about hoping that he would not come was all hypocrisy. Of course he would come. What could he do else but come? She knew he would come. The ship came swiftly nearer and nearer. As they went in, 2 meters at the landing place at the quay, Emmy's knees trembled, so that she scarcely could run. She would have liked to kneel down, and say her prayers of thanks there. Oh, she thought, she would be all her life saying them. It was such a bad day, that as the vessel came alongside of the quay there were no idlers abroad, scarcely even a commissioner on the lookout for the few passengers in the steamer. That young scapegrace George had fled to, and as the gentleman in the old cloak lined with red stuff stepped onto the shore, there was scarcely anyone present to see what took place, which was briefly this. A lady in a dripping white bonnet and shawl, with her two little hands out before her, went up to him, and in the next minute as he had altogether disappeared under the folds of the old cloak, and was kissing one of his hands with all her might, whilst the other, I suppose, was engaged in holding her to his heart which her head just about reached, and in preventing her from tumbling down. She was murmuring something about forgive dear William dear, dear, dearest friend kiss, 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 and so forth, and in fact went on under the cloak in an absurd manner. When Emmy emerged from it, she still kept tight hold of one of William's hands, and looked up in his face. It was full of sadness and tender love and pity. She understood its reproach and hung down her head. It was time you sent for me, dear Amelia, he said. You will never go again, William? No, never, he answered, and pressed the dear little soul once more to his heart. As they issued out of the custom house precincts, Georgie broke out on them, with his telescope up to his eye, and a loud laugh of welcome. He danced round the couple, and performed many facetious antics as he led them up to the house. Joe's wasn't up yet. Becky not visible though she looked at them through the blinds. Georgie ran off to see about breakfast. Emmy, whose shawl and bonnet were off in the passage in the hands of Mrs. Payne, now went to undo the clasp of William's cloak, and we will, if you please, go with George, and look after breakfast for the Colonel. The vessel is in port. He has got the prize he has been trying for all his life. The bird has come in at last. There it is with its head on his shoulder, billing, and cooing close up to his heart, with soft outstretched fluttering wings. This is what he has asked for every day and hour for 18 years. This is what he pined after. Here it is the summit, the end, the last page of the third volume. Goodbye, Colonel, God bless you, honest William. Farewell, dear Amelia, grow green again, tender little parasite, round the rugged old oak to which you cling. Perhaps it was compunction towards the kind and simple creature who had been the first in life to defend her. Perhaps it was a dislike to all such sentimental scenes, but Rebecca, satisfied with her part in the transaction, never presented herself before Colonel Dobbin and the lady whom he married. Particular business, she said, took her to Bruges, whither she went, and only Georgie and his uncle were present at the marriage ceremony. When it was over, and Georgie had rejoined his parents, Mrs. Becky returned, just for a few days, to comfort the solitary bachelor, Joseph Sedley. He preferred a continental life, he said, and declined to join in housekeeping with his sister and her husband. Emmy was very glad in her heart to think that as he had written to her husband before she read or knew of that letter of George's. Knew it all along, William said. But could I use that weapon against the poor fellow's memory? It was that which made me suffer so, when you never speak of that day again, Emmy cried out, so contrite and humble that William turned off the conversation by his account of Glorvina and dear old Peggy O'Dowd, with whom he was sitting when the letter of recall reached him. If you hadn't sent for me, he added with a laugh, who knows what Glorvina's name might be now? At present it is Glorvina Posky, now Mrs. Major Posky. She took him on the death of his first wife, having resolved never to marry out of the regiment. Lady O'Dowd is also so attached to it that, she says, if anything were to happen to Mick, betted she'd come back and marry some of 'em. But the Major General is quite well, and lives in great splendor at O'Dowd's town, with a pack of beagles, and, with the exception of perhaps their neighbor, Haggarty of Castle Haggarty, he is the first man of his county. Her ladyship still dances jigs, and insisted on standing up with the master of the horse at the Lord Lieutenant's last ball. Both she and Glorvina declared that Dobbin had used the latter shamefully, but Posky falling in, Glorvina was consoled, and a beautiful turban from Paris appeased the wrath of Lady O'Dowd. When Colonel Dobbin quitted the service, which he did immediately after his marriage, he rented a pretty little country place in Hampshire, not far from Queen's Crawley, where, after the passing of the Reform Bill, Sir Pitt and his family constantly resided now. All idea of a peerage was out of the question, the baronet's two seats in Parliament being lost. He was both out of pocket and out of spirits by that catastrophe, failed in his health, and prophesied the speedy ruin of the empire. Lady Jane and Mrs. Dobbin became great friends. There was a perpetual crossing of pony chaises between the hall and the evergreens, the colonel's place rented of his friend Major Ponto, who was abroad with his family. Her ladyship was godmother to Mrs. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.